Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 255, and we're going to talk about 10 ways to charge those batteries that we don't talk about. Now that's right, no solar, no battery to battery, just weird stuff. We're also going to talk about the strangest product review item I think I've ever had on the show. We're going to talk about Meshtastic, which is a way to connect without the internet, and a bunch of other stuff. Thanks very much for joining me here once again for episode 255. I'm very happy that you're here. And we have a couple little things to talk about before we jump in here. First, somebody in the Discord channel, Repro, suggested that since the show is necessarily US focused, because that's where I am and I'm doing this by myself, that maybe I should invite folks from around the world to share van life in their country. And I thought about that, and I think that's actually an excellent idea. And what I'm putting together in my head is maybe a series of questions that I could send out and give to folks so they could say, you know, what van life was like in Portugal, or New Zealand, or Australia, or Iceland, or Luxembourg, or wherever you happen to be. And I just thought that would be an interesting thing for folks to kind of compare and contrast how van life is different in the U.S. with, you know, our BLM land and things like that that are not necessarily present in, say, England, although they have a different kind of public land and different rules and stuff like that. I know a little bit about these things, but not really enough to talk about them. And since a lot of the listeners to the show are international, I thought I might throw this out there. So I have to think more about this, but I wanted to kind of put it out there for you guys. And if you have any comments, of course, you can send me an email at jeff@built2go. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. Or find me on Facebook at built2go.com, a Facebook group, or in the Discord channel, which is Built to Go, a Discord server. And you can find the links to those things at built2go.com. They'll always be there. Second update is I did actually manage to get into my van last week. And there was a dead mouse in there, which is not too surprising, but that's fine. I fed the dead mouse to the local wildlife. I got in the van, and I hooked up the battery, and I turned the key, and it started right up. It took no effort at all. Seriously, the thing had been sitting there for, wow, I don't know, 5 months? And I turned the key, and it started, and that was great. And you know what happened after that? About 10 seconds later, a light came on the dashboard, and apparently my swirl valves are broken somehow, and I have to figure that out. Oh, I love sprinters. Yeah, swirl valves are this thing that they get clogged up with gunk about the age of my van, and letting the van sit for a long time is a great way to get them to not work. And apparently if you go to the dealer, they'll either replace it for free under warranty if they feel like it, because this was part of a recall involving the DEF system, or they'll say, no, we're not going to do that, and charge you $3,000. Or, if you're lucky, you can spray some of this liquid molly stuff in there, and that'll fix the problem. And I'll tell you what, I'm going to start with that. So I'll let you know how that works. But the idea of like actually being able to use my van this year so far is not working out. Unfortunately, this error message, it's not just a light on the dashboard, it puts the van in limp mode. So I've got no power. Anyway... I have said it all before. I don't need to say it again. So let us move on. This week, based on a question I got via email, I decided to look into something a little different. So we're always talking about solar and battery-to-battery charging, and, you know, DC-to-DC charging, same thing. And sometimes we talk about VSRs, which are voltage-sensing relays that will allow you to charge your leisure batteries with the battery in the front of the vehicle, which is connected to the alternator. So while you're driving, your battery in the back is also getting power, but in a safe way that doesn't impact the battery in the front. So we're not going to talk about those things. We're going to talk about 10 other ways you can charge your batteries that you may not have thought of. And I can tell you before we get into this, there's a reason we don't talk about these things so much. And that's because the ones we talk about are the best, simplest, easiest ones to do. They're the ones you're most likely going to do. But some of you may have different circumstances, and some of these weird ones might work for you. At any rate, I thought we should talk about them so you're at least aware of them. So let's go there. Number one and this one is more common than a lot of the rest of these, a dedicated alternator. Now, depending on the size of your vehicle and what kind of vehicle it is, you may have space for a second alternator. And this is true for large trucks and large vans. A lot of times there'll be a separate alternator there, and you can dedicate an alternator just for your leisure battery. And you might think, why would I do this? And I might say, well, I can think of a couple reasons. One is it can be super high power. You can put in a stronger alternator just to charge your leisure battery, and then it can be turned off, so it'll just idle when you're not using it. Also, it doesn't have to be 12 volts. If you wanted to do a van that was 24 volts or 48 volts or whatever you felt like doing, you could get an alternator that would put that out and charge your leisure battery that way. Now, it's not a terrible idea, and it is nice because you're not overworking the alternator that comes with the van, and you're also not interacting with the 12-volt starter battery at all. Why doesn't everybody do this? Well, it's expensive. You have to buy the alternator, obviously, and you have to pay to have it installed or do it yourself, and you need the vehicle that can handle this. I mean, my NV200, I don't know where the heck I would have put an extra alternator in. The other issue is that alternators are not designed to charge lithium batteries. So you would need some sort of something in between the alternator and your batteries so you would get the right charging profile. And that would probably look like another battery-to-battery charger. So you'd have the alternator, the new alternator put in there, and that would connect to a battery-to-battery charger, which would condition the output so it would be correct for charging your lithium batteries. If you were just going to use lead-acid batteries back there, well, it wouldn't matter, but if you're being this fancy, that seems like an odd choice to me. So it's a thing. Some people do it. There are some really good use cases for doing it, like if you're going to run a whole lot of batteries and need a whole lot of power, or if they're a weird voltage, that might be a good way to go. Number two, and you have to be really dedicated to use this method, the pedal or hand crank recharging method. Yeah, you can actually buy pedals or hand cranks. They kind of look the same. Some of them you can do both ways. It's this device that it's just got like pedals on it, and you can pedal it and it will send out power and you can charge things with it. Now, it's going to take a lot of work. You could maybe charge a very small power bank with this if you really wanted to, but I don't know why you would do this. You have this big heavy thing to carry around and you're probably near a vehicle, right? And the vehicle gives you a lot more opportunities to do this. But you actually can go buy these things. A couple of the names are the K-Tor Power Box and the Pedal-a-Watt. And if you want to just put some power into it, some human power into it, you can do that. And maybe you're like, well, I'm going to exercise anyway. I might as well make power with it. Yep, that is a thing you can do. But boy, I don't see that as a really good solution, because the amount of energy you're going to have to expend to charge, say, a normal size battery bank is probably, that'll be your entire day's activity. And then you'll go to bed and you won't need the power anyway because you'll be too tired to use it. Number three, and I have seen this in a lot of videos, water turbines. So you might say, hey, I want to live in a van down by the river. And you might think, people put hydropower plants on rivers. Why can't I? Well, you can. There's this one product called the Water Lily that you can toss it in the river and it will generate power. There's a turbine in it and the water goes through, generates power, and that'll come back to your van and you can charge batteries with it. But it seems pretty niche to me. I mean, you're going to have to be in the right area where your van can be close enough to the river to actually reach it, because obviously it has a cable. And the river's got to be the kind of river where you can put this thing in there and it will get enough water flow over it. And, I mean, I have a van down by the river, but there's no way I'm going to put one of these in the Illinois River. It's much too big of a river, and it's much too slow, because Illinois is flat. So we have very slow rivers. But it's an intriguing idea, and do you know where this thing could actually work? Sorta, kinda, maybe? I don't know that this is a van life solution, but if you put one in the gutter of your downspout on like a garage, and for some reason you needed power when it was raining heavily, like let's say you had a pump that was used to pump something out when it was raining. This might, you could maybe hook this thing up so that the water coming down the downspout would spin this thing and give power to something. I don't know. It's crazy. This is definitely experimental territory here, but nothing wrong with experimenting. So yeah, that's a thing, the water lily. Number four, and this one comes up a lot actually, micro wind power or portable wind turbines. Why not? You may see sailboats that have propellers in the back. I mean in the air, not in the water. They're windmills, and sailboats need the wind. So where there is a sailboat, there will be wind, and because there's wind, you can spin a generator, and that will generate power for whatever you're using. And again, you would send that through some conditioner box, you know, even a solar controller, maybe you could send it through there so you'd get the right power to your batteries. But yes, that works. However, it isn't such a great solution for vans. You have the obvious problem of wind being variable, so you can't really count on it. I mean, maybe you have a place that's always windy, those places do exist, and you're like, well, this will work there. But to really get any effective wind speed out of these, they typically have to be up in the air as much as 30 feet, at least 10 feet. And they're noisy. So if you were camping with people, they may not appreciate the noise the windmill makes. So then when you move around, you've got this pole and you've got this big windmill thing. It ends up not being very practical. It does work, and I'm sure there are specific setups where it would be a good solution, but you're going to have to find them because I can't think of them right now. There's a bunch of ones out there. One mentioned is the Rutland 504, but you won't have any trouble finding portable windmills. It's a fairly common thing that's mentioned, but most people who actually buy them are disappointed. Number five, and this is niche too, thermoelectric generators. So this is a bit odd. Well, I guess they all are, but this one's especially odd. This is the idea that you can make power from a fire. And I don't mean in the sense that you're generating steam and the steam is, you know, spinning a turbine or anything like that. No. This is a device that directly turns the heat from the fire into electricity. And there's a couple of ways that are on the market. One is the BioLite camp stove, and another is this thing called ThermoCharge. And basically, you can charge your phone with a campfire, is the idea here. You're not going to charge your whole van. You might be able to get enough power to actually cook, although you've got a fire. You could just cook on the fire, so I'm not really sure the value of that, but it's a thing. This is a thing that you can do. And there may be certain circumstances where it's very valuable. If I were hiking the Appalachian Trail, which I don't think I will ever do, that might be useful because I could just, you know, have a fire at night where it was permitted and then charge my phone while I was having the fire. That could be a good thing. So go ahead and search for ThermoCharge if you want to see the one that powers phones, because that's probably the most intriguing. Now, here's an interesting idea that's very, very practical. It just requires you to be able to move around a bit and have a lot of extra resources, and that is battery swapping. Say that you worked in a place that you were allowed to use their power outlets, but you didn't sleep there. Your van was 10 miles away, whatever, and you commuted, and you didn't have any way to charge your power station in your van. Well, what if you bought another power station, and you always left one at work? And overnight it would charge, and then when you went to work the next day, you'd swap them. Swapping batteries is a way to keep your charge up. If you have a way to have two sets of batteries and then somehow charge them remotely, again, you have to be in exactly the right circumstances for this, but I do think it could work, and it would be pretty simple. You wouldn't need to buy anything. You would just need the power. Well, I have to buy the power station, but that's all you would need. The power station would be in the van. You wouldn't need any solar panels or wires or anything else. Maybe you don't live in your mom's basement, but maybe you're really friendly with mom and she would let you do this. And depending on how much power you use, maybe you can go there every day or every couple days and that's all the charging you need. I don't know. I present it as an idea just for you, the person who actually can do this. Number seven, and this is one directly asked to me by Susan in Canada. So thank you, Susan, for the idea. And that's what generated all this. So this is all Susan's fault. She did this. She asked this question, which led me down this weird rabbit hole. Public charging spots for electric vehicles. What if you used them to charge your batteries in your van. It's actually a fairly big topic. We could probably spend a whole episode on this, but I wanted to address two things. First, there is a Blue Yeti adapter that allows you to do this sort of. It is just an adapter, and you plug it into a level 1 or a level 2 EV charger, not a Tesla charger, and I suppose you could adapt it, maybe, I don't know, but a level 1 or level 2 charger, and then it will charge your Blue Yeti at a very high speed. This would be probably the highest speed you could charge it at. The problem is that I think that adapter is meant for home use only. That's if you have an EV charger in your house. You're not just using your wall outlet to charge your car at home. You actually have a dedicated EV station at home. Like in the condo I'm in the garage, somebody spent $25,000 to put a charging station in his parking space just for him. That would work. That would be totally fine. If you're in that situation, I think it's great. But I think if you go to a public charging station, it's not going to work because how do you pay for the electricity? Now, caveat. I have never charged an EV. I've never used one of these stations. Maybe I'm just completely oblivious to how they work. But my understanding is that either the car connects to the EV station and then you connect to the car via an app of some sort and pay for the power, or there's a screen on the charging station that you use to pay for the power. If it is a screen type situation, that could work. But anyway. It's complicated, and I don't know how it would work, because I do know a data signal has to be sent to the charging station in order for it to start charging, and I don't know if the Blue Yeti device does that. Maybe it does. So if you have a Blue Yeti power station and you have an EV charging station at home, I would recommend this heartily. But if you're out on the road, I don't know that this is going to work, and I notice on Amazon that it's something that is returned very often. So a lot of people try this and it doesn't work. Now, that's one thing. I have seen people do DIY solutions for this where they can go to any charging station in the country and charge their leisure batteries, and they do it with a hack. They basically build a little device that provides power on the data line that tricks the EV station into giving power. Again, I don't know how they're paying for stuff. I'm assuming they're not using the Tesla system. They're using the other system. It's a hack. And because it's a hack, I can't recommend it. You're dealing with a lot of power here. Now, chances are, if something screws up, it's simply not going to work. But it could also cause serious problems. One example I saw was that the guy used a non-Tesla public charger to charge his batteries by getting 110 volts out of it. And then he used that to connect to a regular 110-volt battery charger, and that's how he charges batteries. That worked, but I don't like it. If you've done it and you think it's fine, let me know. I'd be happy to hear your stories. Again, I have never used one of these stations, but I would need to be convinced. I can be convinced, but I just don't think that it's a good thing. The day Anker comes out with the cable to connect it, then I will believe it's a real thing. Right now, not so much. Number 8. Gasoline generators. Now, okay, the RV community is like, well, duh, you have to have a generator. And the van life community is, I don't want one of those stinky, smelly things, and where am I going to put it? Well, yeah, I mean, both sides are right. It depends on how you're camping and what you're doing. RVs have a lot more space. They also need a lot more power. And traditionally, this was the way. I mean, my 1973 Winnebago has a gigantic generator built into it. 50 amps. It's a huge generator in that thing. I can power my entire campground with the Tiki Bago if I have to. So that was a pretty common thing. And, well, there's no reason why you can't do this too. The probably best small generator is the Honda EU2200i. You want an inverter generator if you're going to go this route. But if you want to save some money, the Harbor Freight Predator series has a good reputation for the money. And I have seen those in use, and I think they're probably fine. Why wouldn't you want to do this? Well, you have to keep it outside the van, obviously, unless you're going to build some special heavily ventilated insulated compartment. And then it can get stolen. Obviously, it uses gasoline. It's loud, although the Hondas are very, very quiet. It makes smoke. It's not allowed in some places. You can bother your neighbors. Why would you want to do this? Because not only can you charge your batteries, you can do whatever you want. You can run a space heater. You can run an air conditioner. So I do not like generators very much, but they are a thing that you could use. And of all these things we're talking about, this is the one you're most likely to actually have. Number 9, friction generators. Well, it came up in my search, so I have to mention it. If you are an older person like me, you may remember that you had headlights that you were on your bicycle, and those headlights did not work with batteries in many cases. Those headlights worked by having this little aluminum bottle with a wheel or a gear on the end, and it was on a lever, and you'd push the lever, and that bottle would connect with your tire, and basically as the tire rotated, the little gear would rotate, and it was a dynamo. It produced power, and that would go to the headlight, and the lights would be on. So the way you would turn on the lights is you would engage that thing, not actually flick a switch. Well, that's what we're talking about here. That is a friction generator. And people have said, well, I'm driving down the road. What if I just had a wheel on the ground that this, or what if I connected something to one of the wheels? And technically, the concept is sound. Practically, no, you don't want to do this. This is a silly idea. When you start doing all the math and everything, every other idea is better than this. You're creating a mechanical complexity that you don't need. The efficiency is going to be low. There's just no reason to do this. And the same is true for putting a windmill on your van and driving down the road. All you're doing in that case is turning gas into electricity really, really, really inefficiently. So you don't want to do that either. If you have a situation where you have something rotating at a decent speed, yes, you could use one of these for something. Now, I can think of one way that this could possibly be useful. And again, this is really stretching it. Remember, we talked about those hand crank generators. Well, if you had a bicycle with you, you could flip it over and then use one of these on the wheel of the bicycle and use that to charge things. Yes, that could possibly work. But I think this is not one of the most likely solutions that we have on this list. And number 10 is something that isn't really in existence yet, I don't think. I mean, I've seen a few prototypes, but this is what could be the future, and it's a swappable drop-in battery kit. Now, this is not the same as having two power stations and charging one in your mom's basement. This would be a very large, very substantial battery, probably the same battery you use to power the vehicle. And instead of having to charge it, you would go to a station and literally a robot would come and swap the battery out, and then you would pay some money and drive off. Tom Scott actually did a video about this years ago. I don't remember where. It wasn't in the US, I don't think. And he drove a car in and the robot came and replaced the battery and he drove off. I mean, that is a thing. It may be adopted. Maybe every camping world in the country will have one of these stations and you can just drive your van in there and swap it out. But right now, it's just a thing that could be. But I'll mention it because it's a thing and it would kind of be nice if that worked. One of the challenges to EV is charging stations take a while. What if they were very quick? What if you drove in and drove out 5 minutes later with a newly charged battery? There are 10 different ways that you could charge batteries in your van without using solar or any of the other things. But in the end, go ahead and use solar and the other things. They work. They're affordable. They're well understood. These are all fringy things. Thanks to Chris and Donna, or is it Donna? I'm sorry if I said your name wrong, for buying me diesel at buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go, because they bought me some diesel that I really hope to use in my van someday soon. There are no ads on this podcast. These folks were kind enough to take all the ads away so you don't have to listen to them, they don't have to listen to them, and I don't have to deal with them, and that makes me happy, happy. If you would like to help support the show, please visit buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go, and you can buy me a gallon of diesel too. Special thank you to all of you who do this every month. I really appreciate it. Van Life News! I should probably come up with a way to say that regularly every week, but we'll see what happens, because it's all organic. The rhyming duo of Darren and Karen sent me an article that I asked for. Remember, I was asking for good news? Well, they sent me one. Whether this is news or not is debatable, but it's certainly a good thing to mention, so I'm going to mention it. Yahoo.com, it's called Get Out There, Best Security Tech for Your Van Life, actually from CNET. And they list 10 things that you can use to just stay more secure. And I'll have a link in the show notes so you can read the thing, but I'll go down the list very quickly. One is you could use cellular security cameras. We've talked about that in the past. Trail cameras would work. You can also get dedicated cellular security cameras. And the trick is you don't necessarily want to put them in the vans. If you can put them away from the van so you can see the van, that can be super useful. Because they use the cellular network, you don't have to worry about Wi-Fi. There are glass break sensors that can be useful. I've had these in my house, and they're just these little boxes that listen for the sound of broken glass. That way, if someone breaks in your van, it will know that, and then it will connect to other systems that can then call you on your phone or whatever and say, hey, someone's broken into your van. If you're in your van, you probably are going to know that somebody broke the window. Another thing they suggest is a safe. Now, they're recommending, you know, these articles are often just about recommending products and they get affiliate links for them and stuff. I get that, but the list is still pretty good. A small safe is not a bad idea. However, make sure that if you add a safe to your vehicle, it's either obscured, like not obvious, or it's not removable. A removable safe is a false security because they can steal the whole safe. So make sure if you go this route, you actually secure it. They like one here that's called the Lockley Smart Safe. I am thinking probably not smart is better. You want something simple. Bolt it into the floor or something so they can't take it. That's all I'm asking. And then, all right, I'm going to tell you a secret. In my van, I have a cabinet that's locked. And because my van was an ambulance, I think that's where they kept, like, drugs. And it's very easy to find. And I put my toilet paper in that cabinet. And the reason being that if somebody breaks into my van and they see that, they're going to want to break in there because it's got the key lock on it. That's where the good stuff is. And while there have been some toilet paper crises over the years, yeah, I don't put anything of real value in there simply because it locks. The stuff of real value is someplace else. And number four, they recommend a GPS tracker. Well, sure. You know, if you have an iPhone, those iPhone security tags are great. I have one in all of my vehicles. That is the dead simplest way to do it. But they do have dedicated GPS trackers that are kind of like real time. And if you don't have an iPhone, then maybe this is a better way to go. But, you know, they cost a lot of money. They like the Cube and the Landsea Air and the Spot. And they range in price from $100 to $150. And that's basically where they go with this article. Now, we can talk a whole lot about security, but go ahead and give the article a look and you can keep up on the latest tech. You know, if these products look like something you want, then they'll get a little bit of kickback from that, and that is just fine. Thank you very much to Darren and Karen for sharing that with us. Okay, now, for those of you on Facebook, and a few of you on Discord, but this was mostly a Facebook thing, I played a little trick on you, sorta, kinda. I put up an article called Cracker Barrel Banning Overnight Camping? And I didn't make any commentary on it. I just said, uh-oh, and I posted it, and I just waited to see what happened. And one of the first things that happened was someone said, did you read the article? They're basically saying, everything's the same as it always was. And yeah, that's the gist of the article. There's a thing called Hanlon's Razor, which says that any title in a news article that ends with a question mark can be answered no without even reading the article. And it's not always true. None of these razors are always true, but it's usually true. It's true in this case, too. Basically, the article is nothing more than a story about somebody who went to a Cracker Barrel and the manager came out and said, you can't park here. And they're like, oh, no. Cracker Barrel has always had parking at the manager's discretion. In general, the managers will let you park there, but there are some cases where they won't. Some towns have passed ordinances that don't allow it. In some cases, the parking lot isn't set up for it, and it's not a proper place to do it. But the way the article is worded, the headline anyway, makes it look like Cracker Barrel's getting rid of overnight parking. That is not true. They are not. It's the same as it's always been. And in fact, in Facebook, commented in our Facebook group that they were reading the article from a Cracker Barrel parking lot. So Cracker Barrel's not going away. But the reason I posted that article was to make a point. And that point was about all the other articles about how dangerous it is to travel in the U.S. right now. So I talked about this a couple weeks ago. It's still an issue. And if you watch the news, you're going to see all these stories about people being detained at the border and even being detained inland at these pop-up immigration checkpoints. This is a little bit complicated, and you're going to have to read an article I'm going to recommend to fully understand this. But in the U.S., the Immigration Service only has jurisdiction within 100 miles of a border. Problem is how they define the border. It's very liberal, to use the lowercase dictionary version of that word. That means that they have a wide swath of area where they can operate, including the entire state of Florida, and 100 miles south of Chicago, which most people do not think of being a border city, but because the lake is there, that's where they draw the line, even though the lake technically is in Michigan and Illinois. We share it. So the Immigration Service is out there. They are stopping people, and they are asking for things. And every single time this happens and someone makes a YouTube video or a TikTok of it, the news picks it up, or some news services pick it up and amplify it. Like, you know, fascism has come to America, which is what I just saw on One Today. Now, politics aside, and all the rapid changes that are happening in this country right now, which I have made very clear that I do not agree with, the phenomenon we're seeing here is more related to the way the news works. That Cracker Barrel article was a clickbait kind of thing, but it kind of relates to these immigration checkpoint articles too, because yes, people are being detained, yes, people are being questioned, but they always have been. We just weren't paying that much attention. Now, it is true that it is happening at a higher rate now. More people are being detained, more people are being questioned. And that is not a good thing in my view, but the rate at which it's happening, even though you could say it has doubled, it's still minuscule, because you have to understand just how many people cross the U.S. border. In 2024, 425 million people crossed the border. There's only 333 million in the country. In the U.S. right now, we are on a record for these interventions, and there have been 24,000 so far through April, which is nearly double the average. But, okay, so 24 times 2 is 48, times 2, let's say there's 100,000 of these interactions now every year. Too many? Sure, you can argue that. But when you compare that to 425 million, it's a tiny, tiny number. So if you are traveling in the U.S. or you're thinking of coming to the U.S., and this may not be the year to do that, but if you do, chances are you're going to be just fine. Now, if you are a middle-aged white guy like I am, you are probably going to have less trouble than if you are not that and you have some sort of an accent. That's the pattern. They seem to be targeting people who do not look like me. I am not a fan of this at all. I actually think it's despicable. But I think if you are one of those folks, you need to be more careful. You need to have all your ducks in a row. And that's why I'm going to recommend this article. It's called Know Your Rights at Immigration Checkpoints by the ACLU, and it's just a list of what your rights are and what you can do, and not only that, but what you can expect. This stuff is not obvious. It's complex. For example, American citizens, U.S. citizens, like me, coming back into the U.S., we do not have a right against search and seizure. They have the right to search my phone anytime they want, until I get into the United States. A lot of people think that, you know, hey, I'm American, you can't touch me. Well, yeah, they can. They have that right. But, again, the numbers make it so that it's really not something to worry about. Still, stuff happens, so you want to be prepared. So read this article. It will talk about the fact that if you're a U.S. citizen, you do not need to answer questions at an immigration checkpoint. That is not the same as border control. Border control is different. This would be at a pop-up immigration checkpoint on a highway somewhere. I know that they set them up in Vermont about 90 minutes south of the border. So there, if you are a U.S. citizen, you would not have to answer their questions. You can simply say, I don't wish to answer your questions. They keep talking at you. You can say, am I detained? If they say yes, well, then you're detained, and then you get to see what happens. But if they say no, you can drive off. If you are not a U.S. citizen, by law, you have to answer them and tell them that you're there on a visa or what kind of visa it is, and they may want to see proof of that. So, it's complex, it's legal. Don't listen to me. Don't take my word for it. Check out the article I've linked and a whole bunch of other articles and see what the truth is. But I do want to make the point that despite all these articles and horrible things that are happening, and I don't agree with any of them, the numbers are just not as dramatic as the media would have you believe. And I think that's an important piece of information for you to have too. Tech Talk. So Captain Swift, who I believe is about to start a new career, and I wish him all the best of luck in that, asked me about Meshtastic, and I am aware of the idea, but I didn't know about this specific thing. And so I'm going to share this with you guys, and there may be a case where this would be good for you. Obviously, one of the biggest problems out there on the road is that you might be in an area without Wi-Fi or internet, and then what do you do? Well, this is sort of a solution for that if you're part of a community. Basically, you set up your own internet, and all the devices you have with you communicate to each other. And if one of those devices is connected to the internet, it will provide internet for all of them. And this can stretch a long way, like miles, because of the radios these things used. The entire thing, at least this implementation of it, and there are others, is called Meshtastic. And it's an open source, off-grid, decentralized mesh network built to run on affordable, low-power devices. This is absolutely a DIY thing. You can buy pre-made stuff for this, but this is for somebody who's curious about exploring the technology and is willing to put in some work to set it up. This isn't the kind of thing where you can just buy it and then head way out in the middle of BLM land and expect to have internet all the time. That is not what this is. This requires a plan. But it is very, very cool. And if you were in a convoy of some sort and you had some tech-savvy people in that group, this might be a great solution for, say, one person to have Starlink and everybody else to use it in one form or another. I'm not going to talk very much more about it because I really don't know that much about it. But I, again, want you to be aware of it, that there is this solution. You can simply go to meshtastic.org. And read about it and learn about it. And the whole thing is there. They've got all the YouTube channels. They have a Discord server. They've got everything to walk you through it. There are some commercial products involved here, but this is basically an open source effort, and it looks really cool to me. I think it's a great idea. And who knows what's going to happen in the future? Maybe Starlink is going to fail or whatever. We need to look at some of these technologies to help us stay connected. Product review. This is the strangest thing I've ever reviewed. I've reviewed some strange things. This is weird. I'm going to read you the description of it. It is the Galvanox battery voltage tester designed for Leatherman Multi-Tools flat bit slot accessory, DC voltage meter 2.5 volts DC to 30 volts DC. Yes, folks, it is a multimeter that fits inside your Leatherman. If you don't know what a Leatherman is, it's a multi-tool. It's one of those things you put in your pocket that has pliers and a bunch of knives. It's kind of like a modern, useful version of a Swiss Army knife. I love them. So when I saw this thing, and saw it was only $18, which is actually a little expensive, but whatever, I was like, that's ridiculous. I mean, why would I want a voltage tester inside my Leatherman? And then I thought, well, you know, there are lots of times when I just want to know if a circuit's alive or not, and rather than sticking my tongue on it, this thing could actually be useful. So imagine this. First off, you have to imagine a Leatherman. Imagine a multi-tool. It has things that fold out, okay? There are several different kinds of Leatherman. That was the guy's name, by the way. The guy's name was Leatherman, so it's not ever Leathermen. It's a Leatherman. There are several of them that have these flat bits that can be removed, and, you know, they're for screwdrivers, usually. But this device fits into one of those, and it's a piece of brass that's sort of shaped like an arrow with like a triangle at one end, and it has some circuitry on it. And what you do is you touch the tip of the tool to half of the circuit, and then you touch another part of your Leatherman to the other part of the circuit. So typically you will extend a screwdriver or something from the other side, and then when you touch those two points, a series of flashing LEDs will appear to tell you what the voltage is. Now, I've tried it, and it works. It absolutely works as described. Do I recommend this thing? Only in certain circumstances. I mean, first off, it's the same price as a multimeter. You can get a full fledged, not a very good quality, but a full-fledged multimeter for that price. That will be better in every circumstance, except for the one circumstance where you don't have it with you. This thing is so small that, depending on the Leatherman you have, you could leave it in your Leatherman, or you could leave it in the case for the Leatherman, or just put it in your pocket. This thing is tiny. It's like two micro SD cards put together, only thinner. I mean, it's really a small thing. As for usability, it is a little tricky. If you're going to use it just to detect if a circuit was live or not, like you're working in your van, you know it's a 12-volt circuit, you just want to tell if it's live, yeah, it'd be great for that. If you want to tell how many volts it is, though, it's a little tricky because the way the thing works is it has three LEDs, red, green, and yellow. Actually, I think it's red, yellow, and green, like stoplights. And it's like an abacus. The red is tens, the yellow is ones, and the green is point ones. And you count how many times they flash. So for 12 volts, it would be one red, two yellows, and then zero greens. That's 12 volts, 1 plus 2. If it was 12.7 volts, the normal charge of a lead acid battery, it would be one red, two yellows, and then seven greens. That would be 12.7. And they're very close together, and the green and yellow look very similar. So it would take a lot of work to use it that way. I think if you need to know the exact voltage of something, you're going to be much better off going to get your multimeter at that point. I think you're going to be better off. And that's all it does. It doesn't do continuity or anything like that. There is another one called the Volti Switch that does do all that stuff, but it's $42, and I'm just not even going to try it. So there's a link in the show notes. It's a fun little thing. I love the concept. I think it's very ambitious. And it is actually usable if you need to. But I think that in almost every case, you're going to really wish you had a multimeter with you. I will toss it in my stuff, and I'll always have it with me. A place to visit. So last week I talked too long and skipped a place to visit. This week I'm talking too long and I'm going to skip Tales from the Road. I don't know why I'm talking so long lately, but I am. So a place to visit, Villefranche-sur-Mer on the French Riviera, on the Azure Coast, the Côte d'Azur, into the Alps province, blah, blah, blah. Hey, this place is actually pretty cool. I don't know who gets over to this part of France, you know. So this is the very, very southeastern part of France, not too far from Monaco, east of Marseille, and it's a big yachting community. This is, you know, ritzy, kind of like the French version of Monaco almost. But it's really cute. I had a lovely day there. We had a port call there, spent the day, and I basically want to point out one bar in this town. Again, ritzy town, but still very nice to visit and just walk around. And it's the rich part of Europe. If that's your thing, this is a good place to go. But it's not as rich as Monaco. It's not that crazy. It's not like casino town or anything like that. So there's lots of bars, and there's a beach and a waterfront. And one of the bars is called Surcouf, S-U-R-C-O-U-F, Surcouf. And when you go inside, it looks like an old sailing ship. Like, really looks a lot like an old sailing ship. It's just kind of a fun space to be in. And their version of a bar is a little different than the U.S. version of a bar. This is a snack bar. It's a bar you go to get snacks. So, while in the U.S. a snack bar is like what you have at the movie theater, this is, they serve drinks and sandwiches and things like that, but it's a snack bar. That was kind of fun. The name of this place, the Surcouf, is named after a pirate named Robert Surcouf, or Robert Surcouf. And apparently the place is named after him, and they're basically recreating his ship as the bar. It's been there for a long time. It's wonderful. But it opens up a rabbit hole. If you search on the word Surcouf, not only will you find information about Robert Surcouf, the pirate. I'm sorry, he wasn't a pirate. He was a privateer. Okay, whatever his papers were, he was still stealing stuff from other people's ships. You will also find out about a French submarine called the Surcouf that had a storied history in World War II because this thing was weird. It was this massive submarine that had gigantic guns on it. It was like a cruiser submarine. Didn't have that like one little wimpy gun that, you know, if you've ever seen U-571, whatever the movie was with Matthew McConaughey, you know, they didn't use those guns very much. They used them pretty much like after they torpedoed a ship, that if it wasn't really quite sinking all the way, they might shoot it a couple times. This thing was like, no, this was artillery. This was like, they're going to bombard the coast with this thing. And it was a submarine. Very strange. World's largest submarine at the time, but had a crazy history. Has absolutely nothing with this town I'm telling you to go visit, except for the name. And, one other thing. Yeah, it was also an aircraft carrier. It had aircraft on it. All right, it had one aircraft. The thing had a plane. It was a submarine that had a plane it could launch. It's a really crazy thing. And so I learned all this simply because I wanted a snack, and I was in this town, and the Surcouf looked like an interesting place to go. So go ahead and check it out. If you happen to be on the French Riviera, go into this place, learn about the pirate guy, but also take some time to learn about this massive submarine aircraft carrier and its really weird history. Resource recommendation. So in my hunting for another iOverlander type thing, I went and revisited Campendium, which is an old one that's been around for a while, comparable to iOverlander, but they were recently bought by Road Trippers. And I was like, oh, I wonder what's happened to Campendium. So they're part of the Road Trippers package, and I should talk about Road Trippers another time, but Campendium is very much like iOverlander. There's a map and filters, and it shows you where stuff is. The good news is that Campendium is still there, standalone. You don't need a Road Trippers account to use it, so it's still there. And you can use it just like iOverlander is on the web. And heck, with iOverlander changing and all these other things are changing, go ahead and put this one in your bookmarks or whatever, because they may have a site that the other ones don't have. I like having all these different resources to cross-check, because if something's on iOverlander and it's not on Campendium, that's interesting. And if it's on both, you get two different takes on the same place. So, Campendium.com, still a thing, still out there. Add it to your quiver. Started to really like that expression. Well, folks, I've talked very long again, so to make it short and sweet, thank you for listening once again. I appreciate it every single time you tune in. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. And next week, Treasures of Our Town. I believe it's going to be released April 28th. I am their special guest. Great episode. I'll talk more about it next week. Until next time, remember the words of Anonymous, who said, I never make the same mistake twice. I make it five or six times just to be sure it's really wrong.